Welcome, everybody, and happy Thursday afternoon, one and all. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, last week, Thursday, one federal judge said, "Dear Donald Trump, you must feed Americans." And on Friday, another federal judge said, "Dear Donald Trump, you must feed Americans." On Monday, just this past week, Monday, the Trump administration says, "Yeah, we'll feed Americans, but not totally. Maybe they'll get half." And then, bizarrely, late Monday, early Tuesday, Donald Trump said, "But no, not really. I'm not going to feed Americans after having the greatest Gatsbyist, let them eat cakeiest, Nero fiddling while Rome burningest party of all time on Saturday at his gilded gold palatial palace in Florida." It's all a bit unseemly. But here's the thing about SNAP benefits. They have knock-on effects in all kinds of other programs. And so as we all struggle to figure out when these benefits will actually hit people's SNAP cards, we've got a great guest to help us understand some of these knock-on effects right here in Wisconsin, especially effects in the Head Start program, which is one of the most effective early education programs that our country has ever seen. And again, all of this being made much, much worse and continuing on with much pain because of the shutdown. And we've got all of these factors intersecting for what could be quite a little perfect storm. With all of that as prequel, Jenny Maurer, head of Wisconsin Head Start Association here in our home state. Thank you so much for spending time with us, Jenny, to help us understand how all these things stitch together and have impacts on everybody's kids here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So let's just get right down to brass tacks. Head Start, extraordinarily successful federal program. Tell us a little bit about what Head Start is, when did it start, and how many kids does it serve here in the state of Wisconsin? Why is it so important?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So here in this year, we're celebrating Head Start's 60th birthday. It was technically in May, but I think we can keep celebrating because, as you said, Maggie, Head Start is really one of the cornerstones of the anti-poverty movement here in Wisconsin and across the nation. And I really like to think of Head Start as a program for working Americans. You know, as a parent myself of young kids, my kids are 10 and 7. I know that I couldn't be here right now if my kids weren't in a safe and nurturing environment. They're school age now. But if my kids didn't have childcare when they were younger, I couldn't get to work. And that's the same story for nearly 15,000 kids and their parents, that right now, those 15,000 kids, the majority of those kids, their parents are working parents. So they're our friends, they're our neighbors, they're working in our hospitality industry, they're working in our schools, they're working in our hospitals. So they're really a part of the economic backbone of our state. So while it's definitely an anti-poverty program that helps do tremendous things for kids in the long term, has great economic benefits, it's really a part of our economic infrastructure today in our state. So it's really helping families today to get to work, and it's driving our economy in the state. When you put all of the Head Start programs together in our state, we're one of the top 100 employers in Wisconsin. So we're helping parents get to work, we're employing people in Wisconsin, and we're spending, Head Start is spending money in the state, buying goods and services all across our state in every pocket of Wisconsin.
Yeah, there's so many parallels between the closures, potential impacts on Head Start, and the economic drag that Donald Trump's refusal to fully fund SNAP benefits also has on the economy, right? In similar form, just as you said, people that work in agriculture, people that work directly in the Head Start programs. That's one source, right, of economic boost. But it's so essential for folks, as you mentioned, the vast majority of families with kids enrolled in Head Start programs and early Head Start programs here in the state of Wisconsin are working. They need that program so that they can go to work. Folks that are using SNAP benefits to make it through, they're using those benefits because the entirety of their paychecks otherwise are being used to pay rent or try to access healthcare. And We need those people to remain in the workforce. It is not good if people cannot go to work because they can't access Head Start or they don't have that additional help that SNAP benefits provide. Talk about the geographic distribution of Head Start participation, some of the demography of how it works here in the state of Wisconsin, because in every single community, someone is using Head Start.
Yeah, so Head Start serves, again, over 15,000 kids from Ashland, way up at the tip of Wisconsin, to Racine at the bottom of Wisconsin, and then in both directions, east and west. So we're in you know, almost every county. There's 39 Head Start programs across the state, and there are Head Start programs that are serving as few as 17 kids, I think is maybe the smallest program. And then there are some really large programs in our urban centers like Milwaukee and Madison. And, you know, Head Start is really filling in for those greatest needs, especially in rural Wisconsin, where there is really just a lack of childcare. So those childcare deserts, and really serving as a springboard for success for families. So really helping to provide not only that no cost childcare, but really working on the family goals that a parent identifies for themselves, whether that's getting additional job training or more stable housing. It's really wrapping those comprehensive services around families to help them with, again, things that they identify that they want to work on so that they can find success and happiness for their family. You know, it's just those things that, again, we all want for our for ourselves as we're going through those really intense times when you're raising young children. It's finding that economic stability so that you can, you know, work on that American dream that we're all striving for here in this country.
So much there, Jenny. Folks, if you're just joining us, my guest for this half hour, her name is Jenny Maurer. She is the executive director of the Head Start programs here in the state of Wisconsin. How many families, how many kids are at risk of losing these, what I'm going to call essential services? And it's not just, quote, childcare. Childcare is early childhood education, which I think is a key element of the Head Start program that people need to keep in mind. How many kids are at risk if we do not see funding come through? And how is Head Start funding? Do you get like one big chunk a year? Does it come monthly, quarterly? How does it work?
Yeah, so that's there's not just a simple answer to that question, Maggie. So I'm going to give you kind of a primer on how Head Start funding works, because it's not just like a check that I have a Head Start grant and I go and I get one big lump sum deposit from the federal government. There's a huge amount of regulatory and process oversight from the federal government, and all of those different Head Start grants that are, again, covering our entire state, in part to lessen the burden of oversight from the federal government, which I think a thing to keep in mind is that when the Trump administration took over, they consolidated dramatically the staff at the federal level to monitor and process grants. So we've seen a huge contraction of the availability of the folks to monitor and process these grants. Now, for the 39 organizations that run Head Start grants in Wisconsin, they have grant renewal dates in every single month except October. So what that means is that here in November, we have two organizations that are waiting for their grant renewal. And what the important thing about that grant renewal is that's what you need. There's two things that are important about that grant renewal. You need that piece of paper from the federal government, and you need a federal budget. Without those two things, a grantee, so Southwest CAP, so that's one of the grantees that closed this week, because they don't have that paper and there's no money from the Fed, because the federal government is not doing its job. That grantee can't pay its bills. They can't buy food to pay for those services for kids and families, and they can't put paychecks out for those workers who are working in those organizations. So again, we have two organizations that are waiting for that grant renewal. Then looking ahead to December, we have three more grantees that will be, if this continues, we have three more organizations that will be in this position in December. And then that continues again in every month except October. So it's an ongoing process where they're waiting for that federal funding. I'll pause there and ask if you have any questions. It's complicated.
The piece that I want people to hear about is that, again, the programs aren't monoliths. There's a lot of local disbursements. There's a lot of administration that attends to this. But the big top line that I want people to hear is the first part that you said, Jenny. And that is, irrespective of the current shutdown, which will end and funds will flow again, what the Trump administration has done, as they have done in virtually every single program that helps working people, folks that may be experiencing a short-term economic hardship, and middle-class families trying to make things work in the era of Donald Trump's tariff terror and rising prices on basically about everything, is that what he has done, irrespective of the shutdown, is to attack and reduce the number of folks that work to administer these programs, right? Making it harder for the local agencies to access them, harder them for the at the federal level to even process the grants, the grant applications. It is, as I say every day at the top of my 5 o'clock hour, their whole objective is to break the thing, not to make it better, not to make it more efficient, not to reach more people, but to literally pull the rug out from under these programs by depriving them of both the funds, but also the personnel to administer the programs. That is the real pernicious and frankly more hidden element. Again, the shutdown will end, but his attacks on the program itself, the efforts to defund it writ large and deprive it of the staffing it needs to operate, are not going away anytime soon. Anything that I said there, Jenny, before we take a few messages that you would like to correct, because I think that is the top line that people need to be understanding.
Yeah, I think the thing that I would hope that your viewers really take home is that Head Start families are working families. It has been, you know, just a really difficult time, both before this shutdown started. These folks are working so hard to care for their kids. These programs are working so hard to make ends meet and to make sure that families are getting to their jobs and to keep the doors open, and that these are our friends and neighbors that are keeping our economy running.
We're going to talk about what your family might do if you're in a Head Start program, outreach efforts, the timelines here, some of the practicalities, the logistics. When we come back on the other side with the executive director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association, Jenny Maurer. Stay with us. Important information ahead right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody, and welcome if you're just joining us. I'm Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm talking this half hour with Jenny Maurer. She's the executive director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association. Want to be very clear here. I'm always trying to get my facts exactly right. Jenny does not run Head Start here in Wisconsin. She is the executive director of the Head Start Association, which advocates on behalf of Head Start families and for the program on a broader level. Thank you for that clarification, Jenny. Let's talk about some of these logistics that people are facing, because I want everybody to have in their mind's eye of someone that you know and love who needs Head Start. They are currently participating in Head Start. They are dropping a couple of their kids off at a Head Start program so that they can go to work. These are not jobs that are paying them tens of thousands of dollars a year. Think minimum wage, slightly over, a lot of service industry, okay? And imagine that that person who's doing what one party seems to want to batter everybody over the head with, which is go to work, work hard, do your thing, pull yourself up by your boots. They're doing that. And then they show up and the doors to the Head Start program are closed one day. They cannot go to work. They cannot earn a paycheck. And they already couldn't afford childcare, healthcare likely too. And that Armageddon coming down the pike as well for so many families. Jenny, what's the timeline here? What kind of outreach is your organization engaging in? Are there potential other programs for folks to gap fill? How is this going to work if folks can't drop their kids off at Head Start programs?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things that are important to note is that right now, this is most critically impacting two programs, Southwest CAP and Sheboygan Human Rights Association. We're really closely watching this fight as it's likely, if this continues, will impact three other programs coming in December. But right now, the remaining Head Start programs, which are the majority, are still open, are still operational. So if you're hearing this and you're nervous about your Head Start program, the first step is to make a call to your program and say, hey, what's going on? Is my program at risk of closure? So don't make any rushed decisions. Don't change your care situation without making that call to your program. I know this can be really scary. We really, as a working parent, I depend on my kids being in a safe place. So I know so thousands of parents depend on having a safe place for their kids. So check with your Head Start program if this is the situation that you're in. Ask. And please reach out. Don't suffer in silence. Make sure that you're making that call. If you are one of the families that is in this situation, I really first want to say that I hear you and I know that this is really scary. I encourage you to reach out to 211, talk to your child care resource and referral that's in your community. And I think that the tough part, Maggie, here is that in our state, we are in a child care crisis in many parts of our community, especially in the area that Southwest CAP is in. There aren't a lot of options. Child care is a really, early care and education writ large is a very fractured system. It's a system that has relied historically on highly skilled but underpaid labor, often women and women of color. And that system just, there's just not enough to make that system work. So there's not a lot of other options for families. And so what we know, what will happen for some of these families is that, what we hope is that the legislators will hear our call and not force families to choose between food, child care, and health care. And we'll think about what it means to be a working family. That's what I hope will happen. But what happens when families lose childcare is that they shuttle children between a number of different care situations because parents are trying to make it work so that they can pay their rent, they can pay their medical bills and put food on the table. They shuttle children between different situations. And then they're trying to choose between, do I pay the rent? Do I get food? And then also, we know that kids are often watched by other children, or they're in unsafe situations, and that's really a scary reality for our communities because 3 and 4 year olds can't watch themselves.
Yeah, folks. Again, we have been joined by Jenny Maurer, the executive director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association. What do we need to ensure, on a long term basis, affordable healthcare and the continuity of the Head Start program?
I think as a society, as a community, we need to really realize that children, again, the parents are working parents. The majority of parents work outside of the home, and we need to realize how hard it is to be a working parent in our society, and that if we want to have a productive economy, that we need to better support early care and education and to understand that Head Start is a critical part of that mix. It is very hard to be a low-income parent. These families are scrapping to make it work. They're hustling. And this Head Start has been a successful program that has huge downstream effects for our economy. Yeah. And it has made it work for our economy. It's going to keep making it work. But all of these programs cost money, but they save us money down the road.
Yeah, just so that folks are clear, I've looked at various analyses of the impact on a return on investment basis of the Head Start program, and it is absolutely undeniable. Some approximates put it at $7 to $9 for every single dollar spent. There are all kinds of downstream impacts, as Jenny was mentioning. This is a program that works. We need to invest in it and continue to invest in it. Thanks so much to Jenny Maurer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association. Folks, stay tuned. When we come back, I'll be joined by another expert from the Center for American Progress Action Fund for a shutdown update. Don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. And welcome if you're just joining us. Really excited to have this conversation this afternoon with my next guest. His name is Will Ragland. He's with the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He's their Vice President of Research, Advocacy, and Outreach. He used to work in the U.S. Department of Education as a special assistant in former Secretary Arne Duncan's office. You know a lot about government, Will, and we're going to talk about the Trump families and specifically Donald Trump's out loud and proud corruption. To set the stage, I think it's really interesting to watch MAGA congressmen and senators sort of tap dance and plead ignorance, and I don't know anything about that. Mark Wayne Mullen with his goofy cowboy hat on this week with Caitlin Collins on CNN was, oh, I don't know anything about the pardon. I don't know anything about that. You'll have to ask the Donald Trump on 60 Minutes this past weekend. I don't know anything about that. I don't know who that is. Of course you do. You're in a $2 billion deal with them through your business, World Liberty Financial, over and over again. But the one that I thought stood out to me the most, Will, was Congressman Comer. And if folks don't remember who Comer is, this is the guy that's always beating the table about Hunter Biden and the Bidens. But these billion-dollar grifts, at least they're out in the open. Let's just take a quick little taste of this to whet the palate of all our listeners, and then we're going to get into some of the work that your organization, the Center for American Progress Action Fund, has been doing to help make this more understandable and transparent for all of us regular Wisconsinites and Americans. Let's listen to Representative Comer try to tap dance a bit.
Based on the family's own financial disclosures, Reuters found the Trump Organization's income from the first half of this year shot from $51 million to $864 million. About $800 million of that is from crypto. And the story details how most of the buyers are foreign investors and how all this money is going to belong to Trump when he leaves office. Is this something that you're going to look into at all?
Well, it's something that we are, like you, reading about this. We're trying to digest it. The difference between the way the Trump family's operating and the Biden family is they're admitting they're doing this. The president campaigned as a business guy. I'm not defending the policy. I think there need to be ethics reforms. And I had a bill that Jamie Raskin killed last week because he thought Kamala Harris.
This is an insane explainer. Well, the corruption's out in the open. And then he starts to just generically talk about ethics laws. Will, thank you so much for being here with us. There's so much going on. Let's talk about the tool that the Center for American Progress Action Fund has put out there, where people can find it. This one is very focused on Donald Trump, the person, and how much money he has made since retaking office. Tell us about it.
Yeah, great to be here, Maggie. So folks can find our tool at TrumpsTakeCounter.org or go to AmericanProgress.org on our homepage, and it'll be right up front. Yeah, so what Tapper mentioned there in his questioning to Comer about the $864 million is based on a Reuters report that only covers the first half of the year. That Reuters report was actually very excellent and has a detailed methodology, which is very similar to ours. But the difference between ours is we have it's counting it in real time by using a set of data tools that we put together that ties into the blockchain and his crypto venture. So anytime there's a trade, a sale, he makes interest off of several of his stablecoin holdings. It gets gobbled up by our tool and tracks up and ticks up like the national debt clock does, for instance. So we're very very excited about having this tool available for advocates, reporters, electeds, leaders, policymakers to really have a constant reference for how much Trump's and in the Trump orbit, his inner circle, specifically his two oldest sons and his wife, have brought in since the election from selling the presidency. You know, we have today counted over $1.8 billion in cash and gifts that he's made. And we've erred on the side of carefulness. We wanted to be very conservative with this number and be able to document every piece of it. We've seen a lot of numbers reported out over the last several months looking at his net worth gain and his paper worth. But a lot of that is meaningless because it's super volatile. It's based on his Trump, the parent company of Trump, the Truth Social. It's very volatile. The price moves up and down. Same with this crypto tokens. And without Trump being president or without his involvement in it, the value drops. So if he tried to sell it and just completely liquidate everything, I don't think he'd be able to sell it for what it's actually listed as. So we wanted to find just the amount of cash that has like come into his wallet and the value of gifts that he's brought in. The vast majority of that comes from three of his primary crypto ventures, $1.2 billion. The rest comes from $90.5 million worth of legal settlements, a $400 million plane from Qatar, and a documentary deal Melania Trump has received from Amazon worth $28 million.
It's big numbers. And yet, as you point out, for example, Forbes has said his net worth has increased about $2 billion since January. Again, what's paper, what's real? I think the important thing, well, if I can put it in my words, and you correct me if I'm wrong, my friend, is that the Center for American Progress Action Funds, Trump's Take Counter.org, makes very conservative, Trump-friendly assumptions about what wealth is specifically gained by Donald Trump, specifically and directly to his pocketbook since taking the presidency over. So it is a, I'm going to call it, it's the lower number. There are other estimates that have much higher estimates, again, of what his total wealth increase, the monetization of the presidency might be. Let's dig into a couple of these, what I'm going to call grifts or schemes. We talked about crypto. That has, and the corruption is bad in and of itself. But each of these different sorts of categories of grift that he has, and we're going to start with crypto, makes him vulnerable, makes our policymaking vulnerable to different risks as regular Americans. So starting with crypto, before we got on air, you were talking a little bit about why this is so dangerous for the potential of foreign influence. And many would argue, especially with the pardoning of the Binance CEO who admitted to some fraud and had been banned from doing business in the US. That pardon, for example, this pay to play is bad, but the idea that foreign governments or actors can use these differing crypto ventures, I'm gonna say grifts and schemes, to effectively buy influence is quite alarming. Tell us a bit about crypto, the various types of these. We've got meme coins and stable coins. What's going on with the crypto?
Yeah, I mean, so stepping back just a little bit, he's setting up a bunch of different, the way I look at it, he's setting up a bunch of buckets of cash, of places for cash to go. And his crypto ventures, and in each one of them, it is designed for a different audience that could curry, that wants to curry favor with him. The crypto ventures definitely seem to be very much designed for foreign actors to curry influence. It's a place that that we know has come from foreign actors. You can trace through the blockchain what exchanges a lot of these transactions have happened on, and a lot of these exchanges are only available in certain places like Russia, Iran, North Korea. So the biggest thing, the most recent quid pro quo that we've seen from this crypto scheme and grift is the pardon of Changpeng Zhao, who is the Binance CEO. Now, Binance is the largest crypto exchange in the world. They were convicted. He pled guilty to enabling money laundering on that platform. And Binance was prohibited to do business in the United States in 2023. The CEO went to jail. Two weeks ago, I believe, CZ, Changpeng Zhao, as he's called, was pardoned. And this will also pave the way for Binance to again do business in the U.S. Now, why did he do that? What did CZ give to Trump that would allow him to do this? Well, he has been a major player in the World Liberty Financial stablecoin, and a stablecoin is basically a cryptocurrency that's tied one to one with the dollar. Okay, so it's usually backed with, you know, U.S. Treasuries, that sort of thing. So he brokered a deal with a UAE tied investment firm. Then that investment firm wanted to invest in Binance. So he brokered that $2 billion deal to be paid in Trump's stablecoin.
And that's the stablecoin that's issued by World Liberty Financial.
That's correct. This is Trump's stablecoin. So that $2 billion, and basically how stablecoin operators make money, that $2 billion goes into a reserve, right? That $2 billion goes into that stablecoin reserve. They use that token to make that investment. That reserve is invested in a bunch of treasuries. The yield and interest from those treasuries goes right back to Trump. And what we've calculated, and basically he's made $15 to $20 million from that one transaction alone from this year. So essentially, the Trump family has gotten up to $20 million. It is his most steadiest stream of income. So currently he's making roughly $90,000 per day just from the interest from that one piece.
And all he had to do is give a pardon to a guy who effectively money laundered for various terrorist organizations. No problem.
Right. I mean, admitted to it, right?
Pled guilty. Admitted to it.
And that's just the beginning, right?
Right.
So a lot of there are a number of crypto firms, crypto exchanges, crypto ventures that are in the U.S. that have also given to his inaugural fund, his super PAC, a lot of which were donated after he became president.
Right.
And as a result, they've had investigations dropped. There have been dozens of investigations dropped on crypto exchanges like Gemini, which is run by the Winklevoss twins and gave close to $5 million. So it's a very quid pro quo scheme here that a lot of the crypto industry has been able to not only get investigations dropped, but friendly policy and regulatory relief passed.
And it's important for people to remember back to Trump and his first administration. You can see the grift so much more clearly when you understand that Donald Trump was very anti-crypto for the entirety of his first administration, until leading up to his inaugural, they figured out, like, hey, this is a way to make a ton of money. And I wanted to be very clear about two different pathways that the grift surrounding crypto is working. One is, excuse me, the direct selling of meme coins, right, which are basically valueless nonsense. And he gave away dinners for free with him. He's basically sold access to the people that spent the most buying these worthless meme coins. That's a direct pay. It can be people from foreign governments. There's the World Liberty Financial stablecoin. But what you described is where other crypto businesses donate to his super PAC, and one can ask questions about why one needs a super PAC after you've lost your after you've won your second term as president and you're not running for anything else again, or to his inaugural fund, or to now his vanity project ballroom fund. And what happens to that money if they don't use all of it, and who gets it? That's another way. We're going to come back, talk more with Will Ragland, excuse me, the VP of Research, Advocacy, and Outreach at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. We'll detail more of the avenues how Donald Trump has monetized the presidency to serve himself. Because that's what this is about, folks. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. I'm talking to Will Ragland. He's the VP of Research, Advocacy, and Outreach for the Center for American Progress Action Fund. You can find all of their great work at AmericanProgress.org. They have recently published and put out there for everybody to see and use, you, elected officials, folks that are concerned about corruption in government, a tabulator of specifically Donald Trump's wealth gains from selling the presidency, selling access, or other things that look like basically corruption and grift. That is at trumpstake.com. TrumpsTakeCounter.org. That's TrumpsTakeCounter.org. Well, thanks for hanging out with us a little bit. We were talking in the break. There's a couple of other organizations that have similar yet different methodologies for their corruption calculators. Tell us a little bit about those. We'll put those links for all of this, as well as the Reuters article that you mentioned earlier on the program, in our show notes for today. Folks, find those at civicmedia.us/shows. What are the other, there's a couple other good counters out there.
Yeah, well, there's our good friends at More Perfect Union have put together a database of inaugural fund and ballroom donors in a really great spreadsheet and interactive map that shows how much they gave and what they've gotten out of it. And you can find that at perfectunion.us. You know, for instance, one of their top pieces here is from Pilgrim's Pride, which gave $5 million to the inaugural fund and got all kinds of regulatory relief around the speed at which they can manufacture and process chicken, which is, you know, big, can be a big labor concern. It goes everything to Amazon and corporations facing antitrust issues. It's just a fantastic site, and they've done a lot of work on it. And I'd also note the great work over at Public Citizen. They are also tracking ballroom donors and the amount of money these donors have, or the amount, the worth of contracts these donors have in front of the federal government, along with a tracker of investigations that are being dropped or halted by the Trump administration by folks who have given to either his Super PAC inaugural fund or some other money bucket.
Money buckets, that's what it's about. Buckets and buckets of money, as many buckets as we can and as much money as we can. My name is Donald Trump, proud to be serving the American public by profiteering off the presidency, something that's supposed to be illegal. We're not even going to talk about the emoluments clause, because what emoluments clause? If there's nobody to enforce it or even investigate it, it's not a real thing. We've been talking specifically about the UAE Binance Trump Organization, World Liberty Financial stablecoin grift that is netting him a ton of money, $90,000 a day. Wouldn't it be that, you know, folks trying to get their SNAP benefits would take $90,000 for the year? Anyways, I've digressed. We talked about the fact that whether it's Representative Comer, Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, or also, of course, Speaker Johnson, they all plead ignorance. I don't know anything about the pardon and all these financial dealings. Go ask somebody else. But the relationship with the UAE didn't stop with just that. There was also this very interesting granting of access to U.S. chips that Donald Trump did earlier this year that benefits the UAE. And again, you're going to catch a theme here, folks. Eric Trump gets asked about that and the appearance of pay to play by is it Andrew Cuomo? I don't want to get the Cuomos confused, but the Cuomo that's now on OAN, I think it is, asked him specifically about this. And Eric Trump, again, it's the, why are you even asking me about this? Well, because it looks like corruption, sir. But take a listen, because here it is again.
My question for you is, you know what the climate is.
Yeah.
Why would you put yourself in a situation where you get involved with crypto and have the UAE as one of your big customers, and then they get AI clearance for chips from the U.S. government? You know how that's going to look. You know what's going to happen.
That can't be a serious question. I mean,
but Chris, Eric, why put your family in the position? That's all, Chris, I'm asking. It's a legitimate question.
Chris, I got involved with crypto because I was deplatformed from every bank in the country.
Okay, wrap
Capital
that.
One called me in the middle.
How is that an actual response to what are you saying about the appearance of corruption? I don't care that you got deplatformed, which is an arguable point. That has nothing to do with this particular deal and the obvious pay to play. Another one that happened was Qatar, right? It's not just the $400 million plane, which taxpayers are going to now spend like $1 billion to retrofit and upgrade. That's all fascinating because Donald Trump couldn't abide not having a fancy Nancy plane. But he also is getting a development deal, or the Trump Organization is, in Qatar, which is $5.5 billion worth. And Qatar, which Donald Trump called a terrorist organization, basically, in or funder of terrorist organizations in his first administration, now they're getting like a permanent installation in U.S. security guarantees, a permanent Air Force installation in the United States. We don't have time for the sound, but these aren't things other than the plane that are captured in your counter well. This is part of the reason I say it's conservative. It's not capturing all of these ancillary quid pro quo deals, is it?
We're just tracking the income that's hitting his wallet. And while we do include the plane, you know, we can't really document how much money he's making off of this resort deal and or licensing fees that are happening all across the globe. This is not just happening in the UAE. So, we're being very conservative in making sure that we can document and dot our I's, cross our T's to give people a firm understanding of just how much or what the scale of this is. And I think it's funny that Eric Trump's comments there, you know, I've seen him do this in other places as well. I was like, well, you know, we got hurt so bad, you know, like people debanked us. And the Financial Times recently asked him, hey, is this number seem fair? And around $1 billion, $1.5 billion? He said, no, it's probably more.
Oh my goodness. More than $1.5 billion. Nobody's crying for Eric Trump, I'll say that. We see it in pardon trading, in investigations dropped, in regulatory and policy changes. That is all pay to play. What are the buckets of money? The ballroom fund, the inaugural fund, the legal settlements, the crypto scams, the super PACs, and any other way he can line his pockets. That's going to do it for us. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.